The speaker today is our very own Vice President and Program Chair, Terry Cooper. Terry is a native of Charlottesville and a graduate of Episcopal High School, Princeton University, and the University of Virginia Law School. He's a veteran opposition researcher for the for many Republican campaigns. His highlight reel today will focus on four important political facts, trends, and developments that haven't received the notice they deserve. Terry was a longtime Republican political consultant specializing in issues as well as oppositional research, easy for me to say. And he's largely retired from campaigning consulting, but should be noted that he knows all the key figures in the business, and it's incredible, not only the consultant, but also the candidates. Terry's current business is political analysis, and that's what he's going to talk to us about today. Without further ado, Terry.
Thank you very much for coming. Bonnie and John are passing out copies, hard copies, of all the slides I'm going to be showing today, so you don't have to worry about scrambling to take notes. Rich mentioned that I used to do a lot of campaign consulting and that I've largely retired from that business. The reason is that I concluded that campaign consulting is a young person's business, and that at age 80, I'm perhaps not within that definition anymore. I approach analyzing elections by uncovering and analyzing events that, for whatever reason, events, facts, trends, developments, that for whatever reason have not received the attention I believe they deserved, but could have an enormous impact on politics and on America. Here's the first highlight. According to August 2018, this year, Gallup poll, 57% of Democrats view socialism favorably, substantially more than view capitalism favorably. And 51% of all millennials, regardless of party affiliation, view socialism favorably. On October 29th, the Wall Street Journal published an article that made similar findings. Now, why is that? Well, here's the theory of New York Times columnist Michelle Goldberg. She wrote this: the combination of the Great Recession, the rising cost of education, by which I'm sure she means, among other things, the enormous student loan burden that people carry, the unreliability of health insurance, how much is my deductible going to be, how much is my copay going to be, how much is my premium going to be, am I even going to be able to buy insurance in this locality, and the growing precariousness of the workplace. Remember the old days when you went to work for a company and stayed there until retirement? It ain't happening. And now they've got all these gig jobs. The highest number of new jobs is minimum wage. Well, continuing with what Michelle Goldberg wrote, these factors have left young people with gnawing material insecurity. They have no memory of the widespread failure of communism, but the failures of capitalism are all around them. Now, how did this happen? If Bernie Sanders had been a young baseball player, he would have been labeled a phenom. Unless you're a nerd like me who reads the Congressional Record and watches C-SPAN, you probably never heard of Bernie Sanders until he became a candidate for president. Certainly not when he was a backbench House member from Vermont, and probably not during his first Senate term either. I'd heard of him. I'd followed him. And I thought the guy was absolutely crazy. And let me give you just one example that led me to that conclusion. Every year, Congress takes up the Intelligence Authorization Act. This is the bill that sets aside money for our intelligence agencies like the CIA, the DIA, and the National Security Agency. The bill is quite unusual in that it's highly classified, which means, among other things, that even during floor debate on the subject, you're not supposed to talk about what's in the bill. But every year, Bernie Sanders would go to the floor and offer one, two, or three amendments to cut all accounts in the bill by X percent. He'd typically start off with about 10%. He'd get a few votes, but the amendment would be badly defeated. Then he'd drop down to 5%, get a few more votes, and then he'd drop down to 3%. Now, members of Congress can get access to the text of the intelligence authorization. But to do so, they have to go to a secure room in the Capitol, and they have to sign in. Now, the list of what members had signed in was available to anyone who telephoned the staffers who staffed that secure room. And a number of people, including myself, made that call and asked whether Bernie Sanders had ever signed in to see the intelligence authorization. We found he never had. So on the floor, he was confronted with that fact. And his response was this, and I quote, "It's not my job to read the bill." Now, I thought that was totally irresponsible. And so did the relatively small group of people who, like me, were aware of what he was up to. But then, during his campaign for the presidency, he came out with this commercial. Largely because of that commercial, Bernie's democratic socialist ideas are now viewed by Democrats and millennials as not wacky or even subversive, but mainstream. Ideas like Medicare for all and a guaranteed job for everyone, with the federal government being the employer of last resort, are now mainstream ideas within the Democratic Party. And some of his ideas, like abolishing ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, it has majority strength within the Democratic Party. Highlight number two. This election was having its ebbs and flows, just like every other election. But then something happened, the likes of which I've never seen before. On a tangential issue, which just about everyone assumed that the Republicans would win, and at the 11th hour and 59th minute, a woman, Christine Blasey Ford, came to the fore and accused Judge Brett Kavanaugh, the Republicans' chosen nominee for the Supreme Court, of having sexually harassed her at a party that when they were in high school more than 30 years before. That totally refocused the hearings on the Kavanaugh nomination. And it will plainly have a major impact on the parties, on the 2016 elections, and on politics generally. We just don't know yet what that impact will be. My favorite quote on the subject comes from Brian Howie. Brian is a highly respected political commentator who runs a blog on Indiana politics, and he wrote, "The allegations of Dr. Ford, they just threw a pipe bomb in this race. Now they're waiting to see who the shrapnel takes out." Here are some of the possible casualties of what happened with Christine Blasey Ford's allegations. One is it can take down people who were accused of sexual misconduct but denied it. Another possibility is that it could hinder people who allege sexual misconduct by people who deny it. A third possibility is it'll just indiscriminately go at Republicans, the party of old white privileged men. A fourth possibility is that it could blow up the Me Too movement itself. A fifth possibility, intriguing to me, is the gun safety movement. You'll recall that after the Parkland, Florida school shooting involving Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, a bunch of grassroots movements sprung up across the country, most notably in Florida, but across the country, seeking various forms of gun safety legislation. It remains to be seen how many of those movements survived the Me Too movement. And another possible casualty of this whole affair is comity, particularly in the Senate. We've seen that Dianne Feinstein's credibility with her fellow senators has been blown because she's the one who, back and forth, let the word out about Christine Blasey Ford. Highlight three, the consequences of wave elections. We're hearing all this talk about, is this a red wave election? Is this a blue wave election? Is this none of the above? The general feeling is that wave elections throw out the bad guys. And the good guys, the ones most willing to compromise and are reasonable and moderate, are the ones survive. Ain't so. The damage falls disproportionately on moderates of both parties, the very people most likely to compromise and cross the aisle. Let me give you an example. Back in 2004, the Democrats sensed that a blue wave was coming. And under the leadership of Rahm Emanuel, they recruited lots of moderate Democrats to run in swing districts against moderate Republicans. And many of them won, tossing out the moderate Republicans who had previously held the seats. But then when the red wave of 2010 came along, those moderate Democrats got tossed out. So the people who benefit, or at least aren't hurt, by these wave elections are the hard left and the hard right. In fact, just a few weeks ago, Roll Call published an article in which the leaders of the Freedom Caucus, the hardest of the hard right movements in the House, bragged that they expected to gain members and influence if the Democrats took the House. Highlight four, party loyalty. There's a widespread belief that people are becoming more loyal to their party of choice. In fact, that's true only of the hyper-partisans, the people that the politicians call, quote, the base. The average person identifies less and less with a political party, and that's been going on for years. This is from the Pew Research Center, and as you can see, they've been researching party affiliation back since 1940. At the beginning, their first survey found that Democrats represented 41% of voters, Republicans 35%, and independents 19%. In the most recent year, 2017, the proportion of independents had almost doubled from 19 to 37, and both other parties had lost. Democrats went from 41 to 33, Republicans from 35 to 26. Why, you may ask, has party allegiance declined so much? There are a number of reasons, but I'm going to focus on just two. First, the parties have not delivered on their many promises to deliver for the middle class or so-called working families. Prime example is jobs. Every election, both parties' leaderships promised to create high-paying, career ladder jobs. But their actual agendas have nothing to do with jobs and may even frustrate job creation. Democrats reintroduced the same agenda they've been pursuing since the Clinton years. Tax and fee increases, increased immigration, free trade, and tough environmental controls. Republicans introduced the Reagan agenda: tax cuts, spending cuts, free trade, increased immigration, and cutbacks on environmental regulation. Here's a case in point. Just this past October, House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi spoke at the Harvard Institute of Politics, and according to the account in the Washington Post, she, quote, laid out a policy agenda that, should Democrats win power, that would begin with a campaign finance overhaul package, but also include measures to lower health care and prescription drug costs, change the way the House operates, and offer legal status to the young undocumented immigrants known as Dreamers. As regards the Mueller investigation, Pelosi said that getting the facts and the truth and where they lead us, that's what we have to do, end of quote. Where are the jobs proposals in all of that? They ain't. The second reason for the decline in party loyalty that I want to talk about relates to the American dream. The American dream seems to be increasingly out of reach, but government seems oblivious to that problem. The American dream requires being able to save for the future, for a house, for college for the kids, for retirement, for quality of life improvements. But according to a 2016 Federal Reserve Board study, ...46% of American adults cannot meet a $400 emergency expense without borrowing or selling something they own. And one quarter of adults cannot pay their monthly bills in full. Now, what's a $400 expense? That's around the cost of a single axle brake job on your car, or the cost of removing one impacted wisdom tooth from a teen's mouth. So what that tells me is that 46% of American adults are living paycheck to paycheck, and 19 and a quarter aren't even doing that well and are falling further and further into debt. This is not a Republican problem, and it's not a Democratic problem. It's an everybody problem. Henry Olson, who wrote The Working Class Republican, Ronald Reagan and the Return of Blue Collar Conservatism, put it this way. We essentially have been having a tennis game of realignment for the past decade, with the Democrats and the Republicans taking turns double faulting. They keep taking their eyes off the ball being the middle class voter. Democratic pundit and former candidate Crystal Ball agrees. By the way, she's a UVA grad. And about 10 years ago, she ran for Congress from a district that includes the Fredericksburg area. She said, pungently, politicians have at best only pretended to care about working people, and at worst have screwed them over from trickle-down economics to anti-worker trade deals to union busting to Wall Street bailouts, leaders from both parties have advanced policies that suck the wealth out of America. John Anzalone is a Democratic pollster, a very prominent one. He reported that when he asked focus groups whom Democrats stand for, the answer he used to get was, quote, the middle class. Now the answer he gets is, quote, immigrants, refugees, gays, and those who kneel during the national anthem. And Working America, which is a fairly new AFL-CIO affiliate, and I think these guys really have their hats on right, they systematically asked working class voters who was fighting for them. The single biggest response, no one. One person they questioned was Carol, an African-American working-class voter in Central Ohio, who was asked what difference she saw in her economic well-being when A, Democrats were in power, or B, Republicans were in power. She replied, "Does it even matter?" And from there, let's go to questions.
I have one comment, and that is that I find it fascinating that journalists referred now to the election season, but the season never ends. We count a lot on polls, and considering the number of phone calls I don't answer on my still existing landline, I'm curious to know how we're really going to get accurate, if anywhere near accurate, polls as the use of telephone polling obviously is diminishing.
You have hit on a problem that perplexes every pollster there is. They are having to retool their operations after every election. First and foremost was the rise of cell phone only people. It used to be that you simply couldn't call people on their cell phone without their permission. And then, of course, there's the do not call list. And then there's the tendency of which you spoke, of people simply not to take calls from pollsters or from any unknown number. That is one of the major difficulties facing pollsters today. I don't have a solution.
It's my understanding that focus groups are so much more reliable than polls that that's what people are doing, but I can't imagine someone coming out and saying, well, this focus group said X and therefore so-and-so is going to win. Have you done any work with focus groups?
Not to speak of. It's not necessarily that focus groups are more reliable. It's that they probe more in depth. They get people talking about things that a poll is simply not equipped to ask.
So, Terry, thanks for that upbeat lecture. But isn't it true that you and your colleagues in the profession of political handlers have contributed to this awful state? I think you all, and I'm kidding you a little bit, of course, but anyway, your advice to candidates is to not talk about real issues, but to attack the other side and so forth and so on. That sort of leads us all down into the gutter. So can you offer us any hope that there's any way to get out of this situation and improve things?
the situation to which you referred, Bob, advising candidates not to talk about the real issues, and relatedly, to emphasize negative campaigning as opposed to what your vision for the future is, are two of the principal reasons that I became horribly disillusioned with political consulting and got out, because that was never my way.
Thank you. Another question, seeking the upbeat reply, in a sense. We are all familiar with the story that Chris Matthews has told about how Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill, you know, had their differences and fought in politics, but they got together in the evening and had a drink and a meal or whatever and talked with each other and exchanged ideas and found ways to compromise. Do you see some areas where we might be able to bring us together a little bit better these days? We're going completely the other direction, it seems, not just with the election, but beyond.
Well, we've seen a little bit of that, and one source of it is the bipartisan meetings of women senators that have been occurring very privately on the Hill. And they're good meetings. And in that connection, as I look at the election results so far, I see a lot of these female Democratic candidates coming from unusual backgrounds. I think of Mikey Sherrill in New Jersey, a former helicopter pilot, former prosecutor, credentials up the wazoo. And I think, and by the way, her agenda is infrastructure, because her area is horribly congested. I think that if moderate Republicans have good sense, I mean, to the extent there are any of them left, they will approach her and people like her and see if they can make common ground. And I think that could be one of the two new parties.
Terry, do you think that groups like Indivisible, which are easy access for younger people that take advantage of a lot of digital electronic postings, are responsible, as I do, for some of these candidates who have risen up not out of the usual party hierarchy, but because they found another way?
Absolutely. For years and years, I've been grousing that all Democrats do is complain about losing. But what you saw in this cycle and the last cycle is that they're beginning to go for self-help. And Indivisible and groups like that are very much self-help. I was reading about one group, and there are chapters of this group all over the United States of America, that send people out to canvass and door knock on behalf of candidates in districts hundreds of miles away, who get together in coffee shops and send postcards supporting candidates to the letters to the editor section in Burbank, California, or wherever. And I think this sort of self-help thing is extremely important.
It has been a little discouraging to me to see, particularly after the voting, the counting of the votes, the horrible things in Florida. And can we ensure that going forward for future elections, 2020, that we'll have a system that counts votes all across the country and can do it reliably?
Tommy, we've got a constitutional problem there. The U.S. Constitution does not give the federal government jurisdiction over elections. It has forever entrusted that to the states and the localities. So you would have to have a constitutional amendment to do that. I agree with you. I agree that the current situation is awful, and you ain't seen nothing yet, because it's going to be at least a month and probably a year or more before we know the final results of this election, in large part due to lawsuits.
On the TED Radio Hour last Sunday, they featured Michael Porter, competitive analysis fame, and along with a businesswoman. They were talking about they're asking him to analyze the state of elections, the state of politics. And one of the things he talked about was that which balances reinforces what you said, that the parties aren't particularly interested in solving problems. They're interested in bashing the other side and gaining more power. So they talked about solutions, and some of them are pretty complex, but one touched on the election process, the primary process. One would be open primaries where no party affiliation. I believe they have that in California, at least in some elections. The other is I think it's called rank order, that they have in Maine. And I wonder if you'd be willing to comment on those, on what you think of those.
Well, I would agree that one of the biggest failings of American politics today is that the selection process comes up with about the lowest quality of candidate you can find. I mean, it is as though you went out and said, I really want some bad candidates. And the open primary, which is not only in California, but it's also in Washington State and a variation in Louisiana.
You may want to define it.
This is where all candidates appear on the same ballot. And Washington State has it also, I believe I said. If you want to vote for, let's say, a Republican for governor, a Democrat for lieutenant governor, a Green Party member for senator, you do it. Go right ahead. Everybody's on one ballot. And if nobody gets a majority, the top two finishers face off in the general election. And if somebody gets a majority, that's it. There is no general election. I love that idea myself. The rank-ordered primary, which is held to some extent and with a lot of argument in Maine, because the way the ballot was put on the ballot, I think it applies only to state elections, not to federal. And they're trying to deal with that. This is where you get a ballot, and it has all the candidates on it, and you rank them in numerical order. It's also known as instant runoff. And if your person finishes, let's say, third out of seven, they knock off, I think, the lowest one only at the beginning. So you're still in the ball game. But if your candidate finished seventh, then your vote is effectively transferred away from number seven to your person who was next highest. It's extremely complicated. A bunch of municipalities have this also, by the way.
I know this is my second question, but I thought I'd like to dip down into local politics. I've lived here for 40-some years, and half that time I lived in Albemarle County, and half time I lived in the city. I used to regularly attend the city council meetings. I wouldn't go near a city council meeting now, for my life depended on it. Do you think this is going to keep on carrying forward to other places, or is this just here that we have this?
I can't answer that, Virginia. I simply do not know.
Yeah. Sylvia has a question over here.
My question is, do you think we're going to make any progress on campaign finance reform? So out of control.
Sylvia, the people who write the campaign finance reform laws are who? They're the incumbents from the major parties. The chances of campaign finance reform occurring are really slim and none. Also, you've got constitutional problems, because remember that Buckley versus Vallejo back in the immediate post-Watergate years said that spending campaign money is a form of free speech, which is protected by the Constitution. Now, I have for years advanced the notion that you can get around that, but nobody's taken me up on it.
Well, I want to thank you, Terry, for an excellent presentation.